You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Up next is the third episode in a series on unearthing Oregon history. This is a collaborative series between Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and OPB's Oregon Experience and Evergreen Podcast. In this episode, host Chelsea Rose explores the impact of a beloved Chinese doctor in eastern Oregon during the 1800s.
In John Day, Oregon, inside what's now a state park, a 160-year-old building has stood the test of time. It's got big stone bricks on the bottom, with a wooden porch and stairs that lead up to a second floor that's brightly painted red and green. You might mistake it for a big, colorful old house, if it weren't for the hand-painted sign that reads Kam Wha Chung & Co.
The Kam Wha Chung is a building that survives in what was once the John Day Chinatown neighborhood, which was home to hundreds at its height.
Historical archaeologist Chelsea Rose has been studying this site for a decade through her work with the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and the Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project. Kam Wha Chung and Company was owned and operated by businessman Lung An and Dr. Ng Hay from the 1880s to the 1940s. But the services it provided in those years aren't what makes it unique.
The fact that that building existed is not special. What's special about it is that it survived.
Step through the wooden door.
Oh my gosh, so cool. I love it. Yeah. Oh, wow.
That's Rose with historian Tamara Venet Shelton. And before their eyes,
we can see the actual artifacts that Lung An and Ng Hay owned and used and sold to their community still preserved in this place almost 100 years later, which is pretty incredible.
Through a cutaway window off the main room, you can see shelves lined with boxes, jars, and brown paper packages, all labeled in Cantonese. On a counter below, small bottles for medicines, tools for preparing ingredients like mortars and pestles, and papers for prescriptions and formulas. This is herbalist Ng Hay's apothecary. Today, it's a museum.
This is unique. I mean, this is the biggest and best archive of Chinese herbal medicine anywhere.
Yeah.
Little pieces of different apothecaries exist in Boise, in Los Angeles. I mean, you can find remnants that have somehow managed to survive, but this is like, I don't know, it's like, I was thinking about it like almost like Tutankhamen's tomb, right?
Yeah,
you just open it up, but I mean, it's even better than a tomb because someone lived here.
From the Gert Boyle Studio, I'm Jen Chavez, and this is The Evergreen, a podcast from OPB about the place you call home. Kam Wha Chung was many things to many people. A general store, residence, community center, and medical clinic in a thriving Chinese Oregonian neighborhood. To Ng Hay, a beloved doctor who served residents across the region, it was home. He treated wounds, aches, and illnesses, offering a full suite of health services, including essential women's health care. And contrary to historic stereotypes that painted Chinese herbalists as exotic or non-scientific, Ng Hay's contributions in John Day show how traditional Chinese medicine helped build modern health care, and how places like Kam Wha Chung helped build communities in eastern Oregon and across the American West.
What Ng Hay, what Kam Wha Chung did for this community, not just for Chinese members, but non-Chinese members as well, was it cared for their whole being.
Today, we are continuing our special series in collaboration with Oregon Experience, the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, and Jefferson Public Radio. Chelsea Rose joins us to talk all about unearthing Oregon history at the Kam Wha Chung State Heritage Site. Ng Hay, also known as Doc Hay, was born in 1862. Like many Chinese immigrants in the United States in the late 19th century, he was from Toisan in China's Guangdong province. He immigrated to the U.S. in the 1880s.
He came to John Day as a young man, I think in his early 20s, via Walla Walla, Washington.
At first, he didn't set out to become a doctor.
He came with some family members to be a miner, right?
Yeah.
And he came, he was only about 20, right? He's a young man. He did not have extensive medical training prior to coming here, although he came from a medical family. And I imagine he didn't intend to stay.
Gold strikes in the Blue Mountains in the 1860s had drawn a lot of miners to the area, particularly the nearby John Day River.
There was a large population of Chinese immigrants that came into the area to work in the gold fields and started businesses and had other things.
And a thriving Chinese Oregonian community developed in John Day. By 1870,
Chinese immigrants represented nearly 80% of the miners and over 40% of the general population of Grant County during the height of the gold rush.
But by the 1880s,
there's really a big shift because the gold fields are pretty much played out. So people are already shifting into other industries. For example, we've been tracking, you know, Chinese Americans in the ranching industry.
Remember Buckaroo Sam from our episode about Chinese cowboys? He retired in John Day's Chinatown, and other cowhands and ranch workers lived there in the off-season between jobs. It was in those transitional years that Ing He met his business partner, Lung An. They'd go on to co-own Cam Wah Chung together.
The Cam Wah Chung and Company had many lives, and initially it was a labor broker and a store, and then when it became under the ownership of Lung An and Ing He and their partnership, it expanded even more to include like a medical office and an apothecary.
Another important thing to remember about that time is that this was only a few years after the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act.
During this period between 1882 and 1943, there were a series of laws that restricted the immigration of Chinese people to the United States.
It was a tough time.
We know from the historical record that it was not easy to be Chinese in John Day, right? That there was violence, there was arson.
The exclusion laws divided Chinese communities into two classes, laborers and a more privileged class that included merchants, like the owners of a store. That's not to say Lung An and Ing He were unaffected by exclusion and anti-Chinese discrimination, but their status as business owners provided ways for them to help themselves and other Chinese immigrants navigate the complexities of living in the United States under racist laws. Jennifer Feng is a historical advisor to the Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project and the director of exhibits at the Wing Luke Museum in Seattle.
What Cam Wah Chung offers a picture of is how folks continued to exist and operate and do business and build community within these new restrictions.
The sort of requirements of entry or the ways to circumvent those requirements were always complicated. And I think in very practical ways, folks like Ing He and his business partner Lung An were kind of intermediaries and translators of that process.
They offered people temporary partnerships in the business so they could benefit from merchant status under the law. They also provided translation and aided with immigration in other ways. For a fee. There's an old letter to Lung An from Seattle, archived by the nonprofit Friends of Cam Wah Chung, that informs him of a Chinese man that's been detained at a port of entry in Washington. It reads, "The situation seems very rough. In case he cannot pass the examination, you should try to get a chance for him to be re-examined. Do not let him be sent back to China." Cam Wah Chung also took on new services and roles as the population shifted and exclusion laws affected the neighborhood.
As the larger John Day Chinatown that surrounded it shrank and the community shrank, they had to kind of absorb more of those community operations in-house. Like, for example, they brought the shrine that was in a neighborhood temple into their business.
Cam Wah Chung is certainly a place where you can go to get your medicinal herbs, get your sort of Chinese groceries, but it's also just a place to come together and be in community with one another. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that it's a sort of safe space, or it's a refuge for men in this community who were not always at home in their homes. It was a religious center and recreational center and a community center. I think we do have a little window onto what the full life of Chinese people in Grant County would have been.
Ing He's medical practice was a crucial part of the role Kam Wah Chung played in John Day. He had some sort of medical training, which he really leaned into and expanded into a really, you know, important career for the region. And he served as a doctor to the Chinese American miners, to, you know, folks traveling through. And he really kind of became the family doctor for a lot of people in the region. He was not the area's or even the neighborhood's only doctor, but he quickly established himself as a skilled herbalist and practitioner. He treated all sorts of ailments. For example,
there's a lot of accounts of treating blood poisoning, because I think people working on ranches and out in minefields, they get a cut and it gets infected.
Wounds, pains, illnesses, you name it.
You could get some kind of concoction that he made there, or a dried preparation to take for you to take home, and he'd give you instructions on how to brew it and when to take it.
Archived letters to Ing He from around the Northwest include requests for him to send herbs for an eye condition, a sprained ankle, and lung pain. In another letter, a Chinese herbalist in Portland writes seeking advice for treating a foot disease after hearing that Ing He had successfully healed a patient of a similar affliction. Translations of some of his prescriptions reveal hundreds of ingredients: herbs, flowers, roots, seeds, fruits, peels, and more, combined into complex formulas. He also offered mineral-based remedies known as stone drugs, like cinnabar and charcoal, and other ready-made or patent medicines, some imported from China.
He's making stuff and sourcing stuff locally. He's importing, you know, dried materials for preparations, and he's buying pre-made preparations from the U.S. and from abroad. So he really has a complex network that he's accessing to serve the region.
Many of Ing He's formulas were provided in glass bottles. Okay. And on top of what's preserved in the apothecary, Rose and her colleagues at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology have found a wealth of evidence in excavations of the areas surrounding the building.
What we have here, what strikes me is how much glass we have.
This is archaeologist Keone Diakamos back at the Sula Lab.
I remember when we were digging that site, and I was in the next unit over, and it seemed like you guys were like pulling out an entire bottling plant's worth of glass bottles out of it.
I think in 2022, from one area, we recovered over 50 pounds of glass.
Wow.
And that is just like, it was, you know, some of it's melted, some of it different colors, all different types of bottles.
Some of it came from small, single-dose bottles imported from China.
And these would have contained sometimes pelletized medicine or liquids in very small doses.
Other artifacts included a mix of glass fragments in different colors and sizes.
We know that Ing He repurposed old drink bottles, you know, whether it was alcohol or soda or whatever, for his medicinal preparations. And he would come to you, figure out what's wrong with you, come up with a preparation that was best suited, and then he would send you home with it in a recycled Coke bottle or something like this.
Exactly. So do you think people eventually kind of figure out like, oh, I have all these old bottles, I don't know what to do with. Maybe Doc Hale will use them.
That's right. This is the first reduce, reuse, recycle.
I think that's just, to me, so true to the human experience of being here in Grant County, rather isolated, maybe not having sort of a ready supply line to any of the sort of objects of his work that he would need. And so he makes do, right? And he figures out these workarounds, and that's great.
Ing He used skill and creativity to treat a broad range of medical issues. An important part of that work, which isn't always recognized, is women's health care for patients in John Day and beyond. Coming up after a break,
why women at the time might have preferred to see Chinese herbalists over Western medicine, and how we're expanding our view of Ying He and traditional Chinese medicine today.
Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Let's get back to Chelsea Rose and this episode of Underground History about a beloved 19th century Chinese doctor in Eastern Oregon.
As exclusion laws and other factors led to Chinese immigrant population shifts in John Day, Kamwa Chung adapted with the times.
They shifted to markets that catered to the larger community, including the white community.
The general store, for example, was the first in town to sell bulk and canned goods, according to oral histories. Meanwhile, Ying He's practice expanded to serve many non-Chinese patients.
They were both very savvy to take advantage of market opportunities as they arose.
One of these opportunities was women's healthcare. Tamara Bennett Shelton is the author of Herbs and Roots and has done extensive research on early Chinese American doctors.
Chinese herbalists everywhere in the United States did specifically target women.
Ying He helped women throughout the area with reproductive and sexual health issues, which were quite stigmatized at the time.
There are accounts where he was really helpful with reproductive health, and some people credit him with helping them get pregnant. And that's probably also something that was a really uncomfortable conversation for women with doctors, but clearly he felt like a safe space for many women.
What about traditional Chinese medicine appealed to women? Historian Jennifer Fang says,
when I'm reading between the lines, what I'm hearing is that for a really long time, doctors just haven't been listening to women. And women are seeking out other possible treatments. They're drawn to Chinese medicine in part because it is less invasive.
It was a time when gynecological science was all about surgery. Mm-hmm. It was about,
you have a headache, here's a hysterectomy.
Exactly.
And that was a much riskier proposition back then.
Surgery was still more likely to kill you than not. Yeah. This is before the age of penicillin. One of the great documents from Kamwa Chung is this letter where a woman writes to Ying He and says, I have a tumor on my neck. Can you shrink it with herbs? Because otherwise I have to go see the doctor and I have such a dread of the knife.
Ying He's methods of diagnosis, like pulse diagnosis, were also much less invasive than what was on offer elsewhere.
They are treating you by feeling your pulse, by looking inside of your mouth, by feeling your throat, and that's the bulk of where the diagnosis is coming from. And so I think that as a possible treatment option for women does sound like a better option.
Mainstream American medicine as a field is something that is designed to not just deny women bodily autonomy, but to kind of actively discourage them from demanding it. And, you know, to inhabit a female body has a sort of unique set of biological conditions. It also has a unique set of social and cultural conditions. And I think doctors like Ying He really did provide for women an important alternative to the kind of care they would expect to get from a regular practitioner.
Ying He built trust and relationships with these patients. He and his partner Lung An also saw them as an important business opportunity and advertised their services accordingly.
Deliberately targeting these women through these ads that show these beautiful women of the time dressed in different outfits, sporty, fun outfits.
White women, like Dorothy on ice skates and Clara draped elegantly in robes.
They understood that these adverts that they're producing are not reflecting the women they were actually serving, not in a kind of literal way, but maybe something like what they wanted to be or what they aspired to be.
Other Chinese herbalists also explicitly marketed themselves towards women.
There's a Chinese doctor in Portland. His name was Dr. C.G. Wo, and he put ads in all the local Portland area newspapers on a near daily basis. And there'd be like a picture of him, but then a list of the things that he treated. And specifically, there was like a section of his ads that always stated that he treated like various feminine ailments.
The appeal of traditional Chinese medicine to patients across gender, class, and ethnicity didn't always sit well with white Western institutions of science and medicine. There were efforts to discredit medicinal practices like herbology as folksy, non-scientific.
Quacks, right? Charlatans.
These efforts relied on racial stereotypes and Orientalist tropes, which basically means treating Asian and other Eastern cultures and people as exotic others.
There is a very deliberate campaign among formally trained medical scientists at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century to drive people like Ying Hai out of business.
She says the goal was to consolidate power and force Chinese practitioners out of the marketplace. Ying Hai and other Chinese herbalists of his time were often accused in court of practicing without a license. And it was often female patients who came to these doctors' defense.
Women also did go and testify in court for Chinese doctors. Lots and lots of women would go publicly and say, I went to see my regular doctor, could not be cured, or I was trying to avoid surgery. This doctor cured me.
Attempts to quash traditional Chinese medicine didn't succeed. For one, it was effective. Another interesting reason why is that practitioners noticed how they were being exoticized and used it to their advantage.
I think it's important to not forget about the ways in which Chinese doctors engaged in a degree of self-orientalization, the ways in which doctors lean into these imaginings of China being this like ancient civilization that contains ancient wisdom, the exoticness of all of this. I think that Chinese doctors really had to engage with this to a certain degree to be able to make their services appealing to non-Chinese clientele.
At the same time, though, the type of herbal remedies prescribed by doctors like Ying Hai weren't all that out of the ordinary at the time.
It would have been familiar to ask someone to take plant medicine, to brew a tea or to make a poultice or to have some kind of concoction, because that was something that a lot of these early, you know, pioneers were really used to doing.
And yet, as time went on, some historical interpretations
kind of leaned into the more exotic aspects of this story, and a lot of the humanity of this man and his, like, just relationships with people in the town are lost.
Sometimes stories are told, or, you know, experiences are told through a different lens, if you will. People of Chinese descent are maybe not the ones telling the story.
But there's important work being done to expand our view and deepen our understanding of Chinese herbalists like Ying Hai and other early Chinese Oregonians. For example, translations of documents like prescriptions, formulas, and letters, and comprehensive studies of traditional Chinese medicine practitioners in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Chinese herbalists were everywhere. Everywhere there were Chinese people, there were Chinese herbalists. Even before there was mass immigration from China, Chinese herbs were making their way to American apothecaries. And I think really in these very unseen and unacknowledged ways, Chinese medicine has been foundational to the practice of medicine in the United States.
This influence is evident today, beyond herbology alone.
There's just been the new articles out about the newly discovered circulatory system, the interstitium, I think it's called, which is something that acupuncture has been, you know, addressing for thousands of years.
But the contributions of Chinese practitioners are sometimes hard to see.
They're there, but you have to excavate for them.
Archaeologists like Rose and her colleagues at Sula can help expand on the historical record, too.
at a place like the Kam Wah Chung and Company, where there is like all the contents are already in the building. So we have a ready-made comparative collection that we could be like, we found this thing. What is it? Oh, it looks like this. Archaeology offers another opportunity to put these things in conversation. What's in this curated museum versus what are things that are outside in the dirt that were lost or broken or left behind after time? And artifacts are, in and of themselves, unbiased opportunities to inquire about this kind of stuff.
Work in other areas of the former neighborhood can also provide new understanding of John Day's Chinatown as a whole.
It'd be really interesting at some point to try to connect the medical assemblages in the different households to see, is Inghe their doctor? You know, how is he treating folks within the neighborhood?
Inghe's legacy in a rural Oregon community like John Day can also be found in the generational stories of his many patients.
Still today, people have stories of how he saved their ancestor or, you know, all these different ways in which their family was healed, and it was really like an important part of their family story that still impacts the town and reverberates through the town of John Day, even though he closed up doors like 80 years ago.
Inghe lived in John Day for most of his life until, as his eyesight and health declined, he moved to Portland to convalesce in 1948. His nephew, Bob Waugh, sold the building and its contents to the city. It was later turned into a museum and became a national historic landmark. The residents of John Day are a big part of the reason the apothecary is even here today at all.
We are so lucky that the folks in the late 60s, early 70s recognized what a treasure that place is and worked really hard to preserve it. And there's just so many stories, countless stories of the very dedicated local residents that have cared about that place and advocated for it. You know, our program has been going out there for a decade and we've had really strong community support. And it's been really encouraging to see that this community still is standing up to protect this place for future generations.
Tamara Bennett Shelton, Chelsea Rose, and Jennifer Fang, all hope herbalists like Inghe and other early Chinese Oregonians, can be remembered not as anomalies, but as everyday community members who lived full lives and built relationships with those around them.
They were just normal people, you know, normal people change and absorb new habits and cultural norms. I mean, if anything, I hope that people see folks like Inghe as actual people, you know, and not just sort of exotic. He belonged here. He belonged to this community.
I hope that people think about this as an example of an Oregon experience, you know, not a unique Oregon experience, but just one that survives as a talking point for the thousands of Chinese Oregonians that did similar things and contributed to their communities in similar ways.
Any effort to like discount or write off Inghe's work, it's doing a disservice to both Inghe and to the many people who sought his services. He became a community fixture in John Day, most likely because what he did worked. People viewed his business there as a benefit to the community.
They trusted him.
They trusted him.
To learn more about the history of Inghe and Kam Wah Chung, check out Chelsea Rose's article and video collaboration with Christy Goshi for OPB's Oregon Experience. You can find those at opb.org, and we'll link to them in our show notes. And a special shout out to the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and to our partner station, Jefferson Public Radio, where Rose hosts the podcast Underground History. Check it out at ijpr.org. Thank you for listening to The Evergreen, a podcast from OPB about the place you call home. I produced this episode, and our technical director is Stephen Cray. Layla Isbell mixed and mastered the episode. The OPB podcast team also includes Mia Estrada, Julie Sabatier, and Sage Van Wing. Chelsea Rose, Christy Goshi, and I did the interviews you heard. Alan Joe also helped film and record the interview at the Sula Lab. Music in this episode comes from Audio Network. And if you have a question for us, please reach out. email us at theevergreen@opb.org. I'm Jen Chavez. Catch you later.
You've been listening to a special episode of Underground History with host Chelsea Rose. This episode in the series on Unearthing Oregon History was produced in collaboration with the Oregon Experience and OPB's Evergreen Podcast. I'm Mike Green.